It was July 14th, 2003. And I guess what strikes me as most significant about that time in my life is that it was at a time in my life where everything was going really, really well. I had a lot of success in moving here and kind of creating a pretty ideal life for myself, in the sense that I had found this great job working at Alaska Ch Children's Services, taking kids out into the outdoors, teaching them healthy ways of living and coping. I had also, really fallen in love with the backcountry ski terrain in the Chugach area. I had a nice place but down in Girdwood, but I also had just purchased a small little cabin up in Bear Valley, sort of at the top of the mountain up there. And then, lo and behold, Amber, this gorgeous girl from Minnesota, falls into my life. So everything was really coming together quite well, and just the very next day, actually, after Amber and I had kind of taken our getting to know each other to the next level, had plans to go out fishing. And so it was the sort of thing where, we had spent the night kind of talking and kind of wrapped in each other's arms. And as I said goodbye, I mentioned to her, "Hey, I'll call you tomorrow, or I'll call you later today when I get back from fishing." And of course, that was the phone call that never came. Essentially, it was one of those gorgeous days of fishing. We had spent, far too long out there trying to catch our limit, but we finally did after dinner hours. And so we had just made the 20-minute walk back to the trailhead, at the Grayling Trailhead near the confluence of the Russian and Kenai Rivers, when my dog Maya, who I was with my dog Maya and my friend John, and she lets out just a little growl, just enough to make me look up and, what's this? And sure enough, about 30 feet away or so, was a pretty large grizzly bear. We've had plenty of grizzly encounters in the past. This one was atypical in the sense that she was very clearly agitated from the first point of encounter. She sort of whipped around to face us, was stomping her feet, hair raised on end, started huffing and puffing. And my friend John and I, we conversed, decided the best thing to do was to sort of, continue to make ourselves look big, back away, and really just walk the other way and take a really long way back around to the trailhead, hopefully basically just avoiding the bear altogether. So we had managed to back away successfully, and we're just starting to head upriver and finally starting to relax again, like, whew, that was crazy. When in front of us on the trail, the bushes started shaking, and that was definitely one of those heart-stopping moments where it felt like what had happened was we were being stalked by this bear. And so we quickly turned around and started heading back downriver towards where we had just come, the quickest way back to the trailhead. And we had gotten no more than 10 feet in that direction when suddenly in front of us, the grizzly sow comes ripping around the corner. So we're now faced with a charging bear who's darting at us at missile speed. My dog Maya leaps off the trail in one direction in front of me. My friend John leaps off the trail in another direction, and the bear doesn't change direction. And I'm now the last object, between her and the shaking bushes behind me. And so I leap off the trail into the bushes on the left. But before I had even hit the ground, she had a hold of me and was pulling me out. My dog Maya, who I was with my dog Maya and my friend John, and she lets out just a little growl, just enough to make me look up and, what's this? And sure enough, about 30 feet away or so, was a pretty large grizzly bear. She then picked me up and dragged me off into the forest. All I remember feeling was just the ground moving underneath me very quickly. And at some point, I was kind of in and out of consciousness as she was moving me. And I never forget the feeling of sort of coming back to consciousness, waking up while the mauling is happening. And what struck me the most about those moments was the feeling of her front claws sort of pressing down on my shoulders as she stood over me, but also I'll never forget the massive and powerful sound of her lungs, and just the magnitude of her breath as she huffed and growled. And I heard my friend John calling from a distance loudly, and so I didn't know if there was a rescue underway or if they were searching for me actively. But I knew I'd been drug off the trail a ways, so I wanted them to know where I was. So I let out a call back. And in hindsight, that was a definite mistake because it was too much sign of life for the bear, who then quickly returned to me and delivered what I now refer to as sort of the death blow, which is where she, you know, cocked her head sideways and bit down across my face from side to side. Really crushing a lot of the facial skeleton, the skull. I almost saw my body laying there on the forest floor, and then I was inside of my body, and I all of a sudden was hearing the sounds of the river and the wind in the trees and some chickadees at a distance. And it was like the presence of the peacefulness was back in the forest again, and it was very clear, as opposed to the several times before that when I'd come back to consciousness and the bear was still there. This time, it was very obvious that the bear had gone. My first thought was, you know, how am I doing taking stock and how am I going to get out of here? The thought crossed my mind about, you know, maybe trying to crawl out. But I quickly realized I was in no shape to do that. From my memory, I didn't have much of a capacity to move at all. And I could feel, you know, blood pooling up under my head on the forest floor, and I could feel blood filling in my waders. So I knew I was in bad shape, and really I felt like the only thing I could do was just to lay as still as I could and save every bit of energy for surviving the rescue, which I was hopeful would be coming. So I don't really know how long I waited there, but I would say probably within 20 minutes or so of coming back to consciousness, John, my friend, had connected with a couple of other fishermen, and they made their way to come find me. And immediately when they found me, you know, it was clear things were not good. So John stayed with me. The other two went for help to see if they could get cell phone, a call out for the troopers and whatnot, and to get the EMTs on their way. And it would be about 2 hours before the EMTs would arrive. And during that time, you know, more fishermen started coming to the scene, and it was reported that I was, you know, in and out of consciousness, and that at one point I had even stopped breathing. But shortly before they were going to start compressions, I would sort of gasp for air type of a thing. So I was really in a fine line, a pretty tenuous place there for a while. And it's funny, you know, the things that that I was reported to be saying, you know, it really makes a lot of sense on some level, but it's just interesting the things you think about in those situations. You know, one thing I kept saying, which was kind of obvious thinking back, which was, you know, how come I can hear you, but I can't see you? How come I can hear you, but I can't see you? And nobody had any answers for me for that question. Although, you know, yeah, it might've been pretty obvious to some of them. And then I also kept saying, oh man, is my girlfriend going to kill me? which is funny, you know, for several reasons, the least of which is that I really just started, you know, dating her the night before. So probably wouldn't have been calling her my girlfriend in many circumstances. So it's kind of funny. But the other thing I kept thinking about is that I had the keys to the company van in my pocket, and I knew there was a field trip the next day for a group of teens that I worked with. And I kept thinking, man, how are they going to get these kids there? Like, I've really blown it this time.
I mean, they excused you, right?
Of course.
Best excuse ever.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You know, I was in a really bad way. Not only had, you know, my face experienced a lot of damages, you know, pretty much every bone in my head except for my lower mandible had been broken, and including the palate or the bone structure that holds the brain up into place have been broken or even in many cases pulverized, you know, powdered. And so the brain itself herniated down into my sinuses. The sac that holds it was torn open in several places, so I was leaking cerebral spinal fluid for the next 10 days. And really, the aside from the huge risk of that the trauma presented, then it was an even greater risk almost of then dying from infection. And so the doctors really weren't optimistic when they started working on me. They couldn't begin to reconstruct yet because the swelling and the damages were just too great. The first thing that they needed to do was to basically close everything up, load me full of antibiotics, and hope that I could make it through the next 10 days without a lethal infection. And so, you know, during that time, as my family started to arrive from Lower 48, and my friends would come in, you know, the doctors were pretty straight with them. They were just saying, you know, this is devastating, and it's most likely that, you know, we won't be able to restore any sight if he lives, but he's certainly not out of the woods. And their message was, frank, it was, if you're the type of people that pray, now is the time to pray. I emerged approximately five surgeries later, 6 months later, finally all put back together. The last stubborn wound, which kept reopening on my forehead, finally replaced with the piece of my arm. And then at that point, it became about, okay, now that I'm going to live, how do I go about living as a blind person, you know? And really starting that adventure, for lack of better words, the adventure of trying to get out of bed on your own and find the bathroom, how to cook for yourself, clean for yourself, how to, you know, use computers to read for you, you know, all that stuff that I had really taken for granted for the first 25 years of my life.
Now, I'm sorry, but just to backtrack a second, you said that now that I'm going to live, which means at some point, you know, I think you were conscious of the fact that you might not.
Right.
So very then much so. Was there, I guess when you were aware of the fact that you might not live, do you bother making plans? What is your mindset?
Right. Pretty much, you know, for me during that time of uncertainty, it was just about survival mode. Like, you definitely didn't make plans. And in fact, you didn't really think beyond the moment, or at least I didn't. And certainly not beyond the day. I mean, but pretty much it was just a moment to moment thing. Just really being very mindful about, the use of your energy and trying to stay positive and really just cope with, the physical, pain and so really the emotional pieces weren't even present, you know, as far as like starting to grieve the loss and or deal with emotional pain. That really wasn't even a factor at that point in time, because that would come later after getting out of survival mode. And every now and then it would sort of catch up with me a little too much, and I would cry or, you know, feel sad or whatever. But for the most part, all that emotional stuff would come much later. You know, as I was saying, it sort of puts things into perspective. So I had thoughts about, you know, geez, I almost died without having kids. I almost died without really ever having that love of marriage, you know, that love of your life type of experience. There was so much that I felt like I really wanted to have in life, but came so close to not having any of those opportunities. And of course, at this point, I didn't know how many of those opportunities would still be there, because I had no idea what life would be like, or certainly what life as a blind person would be like. It was really then that I began to really kind of reflect on what had happened to my life, you know, what had happened from this day where everything had been going so well. And now here I was, you know, just a couple of months or a month and some weeks later, and everything was completely up in the air as far as I had no idea what my life would have for me. And I began sort of feeling around on my face, and, you know, it was still totally covered in antibiotic ointments and stuff, but I began to sort of explore with my fingertips, you know, the damage that had been done. And you know, at that time my head and face were still super swollen. And so it felt very odd and awkward. I would have those types of experiences where I was challenged to the very core of my being, and all of my self-identity had been sort of stripped away, that I still had really good friends surrounding me.
So it sounds like you made this important decision to basically go for life and figure out what to do. And a lot of it's because of Amber. Where is she during that time after the bear and before you go down to California?
You know, Amber comes to see me for the first time since being asked to leave. And it's her first time seeing me when I'm awake, you know. I'm sitting up next to the bed in this chair, and I'm not speaking at the time, and so I'm communicating via this dry erase board. And she sits down at my knees on the floor with sort of her hand on my knees, and I write down the words. I say, "I'm blind," and she's like, "Yeah, I know. I'm sorry, you know." And I write down the words. I say, "Crazy," and she's like, "Yeah, it's super crazy." And then I sort of erase, you know, with my rag, the whiteboard, and I scribble down the words, "I'm scared," you know. And she's like, "Yeah, no." Amber continued to hang around just sort of as a friend until it was time for me to go to California to continue those surgeries. And as I, you know, mentioned earlier, we then reconnected sort of over the telephone, which eventually then drew us back together. And it was a year later when I planned my first trip back up to Alaska since blindness. It was in June. And I planned a trip to come up and spend some time with Amber and do some fishing, get back out on the river. We drive back up to her place, her cabin up in Bear Valley. And we're sitting there at first very awkwardly, being in the same room. We, you know, we had not much time together before the bear, and not much time together, me as a blind person, in person, lots of time on the phone. And so it was kind of awkward at first. And, you know, we still weren't totally sure who we were. But once again, we ended up having one of those just remarkable nights that together of really connection that moved us from, you know, friendship status to relationship status, you know, to together. Once again, I woke up the next morning with plans to go fishing with John and with Jaha. So I said, you know, "Hey, honey, I'm going fishing. I'll call you when I get back," you know, just as I had the previous year. It was this strange sort of deja vu and or a second chance, if you will. And I went fishing and proud that not only did I keep that promise to call her that night after fishing, but that I was able to call her and tell her I'd caught a 40-pound king. So it was a real victory lap, as I now refer to it as, in the sense that I got to come back to Alaska, catch the fish, keep the fish, and get the girl.
Dan and Amber were married 3 years after the attack. I interviewed Dan for more than an hour at his home in Anchorage. While I was there, I got to meet his son, Alden, and his daughter, Acacia, and his wife, Amber. And they were having a gathering after our interview, so as I was getting ready to go, more and more friends kept showing up. It struck me that when I was interviewing him, we spent so much time talking about when he had been alone and when he had been fighting for his life all by himself. And now here he was, surrounded by all these people. Dan has a book out now. It's called Beyond the Bear. If you want to learn more, you can just go to danbigley.com. That's Dan Bigley, B-I-G-L-E-Y.com.